Hey guys, it's Jess with a quick soundbite. I wanted to chat today about how to talk to parents about the difference between DIR floor time and ABA or other behavioral type approaches. This question comes up quite a bit because it is really an important piece of working with a lot of our families and our kids with autism is education. Just helping them understand this different approach that we use, one that they probably have not had any exposure or knowledge of prior to coming to our clinic. I hope that will change in the future, but as of right now, the behavioral approaches are kind of the hot topic and they're paid for by insurance. And they're really pushed heavily by doctors who unfortunately don't really know the ins and outs of it. They just know it's the quote unquote gold standard. So we often get families coming in who have already been going to ABA or who are being told they need to go to ABA. A lot of the approaches that we use in DIR floor time do tend to kind of conflict with those other approaches, and it can be really challenging to get a parent on board. I find the most challenging parents to work with in this regard are the parents who have already been going to ABA and are just experiencing DIR for the first time. Our parents who are much more receptive are usually the ones that we are working with before the child gets a diagnosis. So I think one thing to keep in mind is that if you have a child that you suspect may have autism and they end up seeking a diagnosis, that is your time to sort of prime them and start talking about the importance of regulation and engagement and connecting with other people and really laying the foundation for learning, not just teaching rote skills and talking to them about the difference. And I have straight up warned parents, you know, when or if you get an autism diagnosis, they are going to tell you that you must do X number of hours of ABA. I mean, parents, it's literally shoved down their throat is how I've had parents describe it to me. They have ABA clinics start calling them. And I just tell them, it is your choice as the parent, but you do have a choice. It is not a requirement. And your child will still make progress even if you don't do ABA. And here are the benefits of doing some of these other approaches, you know. So I think those are really important relationships to cultivate because you can catch them beforehand. And those families then really walk into that diagnosis feeling empowered. They really feel like, you know what? No, I don't have to do ABA. And I'm not a bad parent if I don't do it. And yes, my child, I mean, we've had doctors literally tell their patients, your child will not make progress unless they do ABA, which we all know is not true. And it, in fact, more recently, the autistic community is coming together saying, no, ABA is abusive and traumatic. And I think it's important that we listen to those voices. So you can direct them to resources that are specifically run by autistic individuals. There's a number of Facebook groups out there. I follow one called Ask Me I'm Autistic. It's mostly for autistic adults, but they allow professionals like myself and others to be in it. And it's really interesting to read about their experiences. But anyways, going back to my initial topic, DIR versus ABA. The other thing I think before we kind of dive into this that we need to think about is where is that parent at in their journey of accepting a diagnosis? I have found from working with parents at all different stages of this that everybody comes in at a different point. I really think that getting a diagnosis like that for your child is a grief process. And if you have taken any psych classes, you may be familiar with the grief process. Off the top of my head, I cannot remember all the stages of grief, but certainly denial comes into that and bargaining and acceptance finally at the end. I think a lot of our parents who are fresh off the diagnosis boat kind of come in wanting a quick fix. They want to see obvious objective change in their child, and they want to see that checklist of issues with their child shorten. And I think in that stage, in that vulnerable stage, that's what ABA gives those parents, unfortunately, because I think that's, it kind of sets them on the wrong path. But, they see that checklist of my kid can't do, he can't stack blocks, he can't tie his shoes, he can't look at me, he can't pay attention for more than 30 seconds to anything. And they want to see those disappear. And ABA gives that to them. They give them a checklist and they say, oh, look, now your kid can do this. Now he can stack blocks. Now he can write his name. Great. Now he isn't autistic. But that's not really what's happening, right? But I think a lot of our parents, they kind of get in that. Like, if I can get rid of these symptoms, my child won't be autistic anymore. That child will still be autistic, and they're always going to have these differences. It's just part of their neurology. But those families who haven't come to that acceptance point, I think, really struggle with that. So I think keep that in mind, because if they're in that stage of grief where they're in denial or they're really trying to fix, I would still advocate and still educate, do everything you can, but don't beat yourself up if you lose that parent. It has taken me years sometimes to connect with the parent and really help them see. And I've done it little by little, little comments here and there, little nuggets of information here and there. I had one patient that I worked with for several years, and, you know, I started with them right after the diagnosis. So they already were on the ABA train, and it was a fast moving train. And I spent a lot of time educating the parent about the differences and why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I didn't bash ABA, and I didn't tell them don't do it or whatever. I mean, this is your choice as a parent. And mom had done a ton of her own research and made that decision. And I supported that, but I'm like, I'm explaining to you why I'm doing what I'm doing. So when she'd come to me and she'd say, why aren't you working on writing with him? I said, he doesn't have the engagement right now. He doesn't have sustained visual attention. He's not interested in writing. Writing's very symbolic. We don't have symbolic thinking yet. So I could teach him to write and he will form letters, but that doesn't mean he's going to sit down and write you a letter, because he has to come up with those thoughts first and he has to organize those thoughts. And there's a whole process behind it. Kids start to learn to write because they have those underlying skills. So it turned out from discussing with her, she was actually more concerned about his hand strength. I'm like, cool, hand strength we can incorporate into play. There are lots of things we can do. Opening containers. He loved food, so we could work on opening food containers. So some of that kind of took some troubleshooting with her. But year after year after year, I just kept kind of gently guiding her in the DIR direction. And finally, one day she came to me and she said, I'm pissed. I feel like this kid has been going to ABA for, you know, 6 or 7 years, and we have not made any progress. She's like, how am I just realizing this? Why can he still not do these things? They just keep working on the same things and he still just can't do it. And it was dressing tasks, and they were tasks that I was also working on. So I was educating her, and here's why I think he can't do it. He doesn't have sustained visual attention. He doesn't have the engagement. He doesn't have the visualization abilities, the perceptual abilities, and he doesn't have the interest. It's not an interest for him. You know, and I said to her, if I took a kid with similar developmental abilities as him and tried to teach them dressing, I mean, we would be working with a young infant at that point. If they didn't have those social emotional skills, I would not be able to get that kid to do it because they just wouldn't be interested. They weren't ready and it wasn't time. So for him to keep his focus on the sequences of these steps, I'm like, this is one of those things where rote learning doesn't always work. I can teach him how to get himself dressed, but if I'm not standing there cueing him through every step and keeping him on task and keeping him engaged in the activity, he's not going to do it on his own. And I think that comes down to a big difference and shows really the holes in his development, right? Of why ABA could not get him fully independent with some of these skills, because he just didn't have the underlying foundation. So mom finally one day realized this and had this huge aha moment. And she looked at me and she said, you've been trying to tell me this all along, haven't you? And I said, yeah, you know, but I said, and she's like, why don't you just tell me? And I said, well, I didn't feel like you were ready. I said, I kind of like I educated and I explained and I still held strong and pushed the engagement pieces. And she looked at me, she was like, you're right. She goes, I totally would not have accepted it. So I think part of it is parents have to be ready to accept this information. That doesn't mean that you have to stop educating. You just might have to be more gentle. But in the very beginning with a very new patient, I always start with just basic overview of here's this approach that I use. Here's what it's called. And it's all based on social emotional development, which is the beginning of development. So these are skills that happen from birth to really 18 months. If you think about those first four levels, birth to 18 months. So these kids that are coming in at 4 and 6 and 10 have these lacking skills that really happen at a much younger age. And if you're targeting skills that they're supposed to be, you know, developing at 4, 6, or 10, whatever their current age is, you're probably neglecting skills that happen much earlier than that, like regulation, engagement, two-way interaction, and just simple social problem solving, those first four levels of DIR. So I explain briefly what those are. You know, we have to be calm and we have to be able to tune out information in our environment to be able to pay attention. If we can't pay attention, you might as well scrap everything because you can't learn. You can't pay attention to other people's social cues, their emotional signals. You can't pay attention to your own body and how you're feeling, your internal sensations. You can't pay attention to verbal or auditory information to learn things around you or imitate other people. So you have to first have regulation. So these kids who come in very dysregulated, I'm always pushing that piece. And then you have to be engaged. You have to be interested. So that's a little bit trickier to obviously to cultivate. But if we don't have that, we also can't learn. If you've ever tried to sit down and force yourself to learn something that you're just not interested in, and that's the example that I often give to families, it doesn't work as well because you're not into it. You have to be invested. And engagement, that level two engagement, really is the foundation for the desire to communicate. Kids learn to communicate because they have a strong relationship and strong engagement skills with a caregiver. You know, my daughter is motivated to communicate to me and signal to me because she wants to be with me and she has a strong relationship with me and engages with me. Without that, they don't have the desire to communicate, and then they tend to stay in their old world, like we see a lot of our kids on the spectrum. That doesn't mean they don't want to engage. It's usually that they just don't know how. So we have to help them with that through play. And through engaging, motivating play that is directed by the child, not things that the parent thinks is quote-unquote appropriate play. So these are the things I'm explaining to them. And I'm like, without that, we can't do A, B, C, D. I always try to phrase it, though, within the context of the parent's concern. So if that parent comes to me and they're like, I want my kid to write. Just like that example I gave with that patient, I talk about, well, why? What do you want them to do with writing? You know, and I can force them to write. I could sit them down at the table and I can, you know, click and treat and do a behavioral approach, and I could get them to probably form the letters. Probably, you know, with some exceptions, not all kids will be able to do that just developmentally. But that doesn't mean they're going to sit down and write anything. I've given examples before of this where I've worked with teens who kind of a similar approach because we didn't have much of a choice at the time. And that kid would not sit down and write out his plan, even though it was the same plan every single week. Couldn't do it unless I was sitting right next to him telling him exactly what to do, because he didn't have sustained engagement in a task. If you let him sit there, he was in his own world because he had never learned to engage with his outside world. And if you can't stay engaged with your outside world, you cannot pay attention. You cannot keep yourself on task. Some of you probably are familiar with one of my kiddos I have currently on Wednesdays where we're working on that same thing. They have skipped working on engagement for so many years, and now he's in his early teens, and I can't tell him, take off your shoes. If I'm not standing right there watching him and repeatedly prompting him over and over again, he won't take off his shoes. He physically knows how to take off his shoes. He physically can take off his shoes, but he cannot sustain engagement in his outside world and keep himself on task without support. Therefore, he doesn't initiate it. He doesn't persist with it. He abandons it, and he checks out and goes into his own world. And he could easily sit there for my entire session and probably more, just staring at the wall, because he is content inside his own world. And that's the piece that we need to help them with. If they can't come out of their own world, they cannot learn and do these tasks completely independently. You will just be teaching splinter skills. So I kind of piece that together little by little, snippets here and there for the parents. But like I said, always within the context of what are they most concerned about? If a parent comes in and says, I want my child to look at me. Why? Why? And then I might ask them, why do you think neurotypical kids look at you? And if they're confused, I go, it's because they're interested in you. They're engaged with you. You're doing something that they enjoy. Now let's apply that to your child. Yes, your child may be interested in rubbing their hands up and down the wall. You don't see that as conventional play. That looks odd to you, so you deter it. But what if you joined them in that and what they're interested in? Because this is what we do in typical development. In typical kids going around, my daughter's down on the floor playing with something. I join her with whatever she's doing. But she is engaging in what looks like quote-unquote normal play. Our kids who have autism have more, I like to call it non-conventional play. I don't like to call it that is abnormal, because it doesn't really matter. Play serves a purpose for that child. Our job is to join their interest, to help them develop this ability to stay in a shared world within their interests first, before they will be able to stay in a shared world in our interests, which would be any adult-directed task. It could be writing, it could be shoe tying, it could be, you know, looking at somebody, it could be paying attention to a lesson, learning how to read. Those are all adult-directed tasks, but they have to first be engaged in their own interests and allow me in that world before they will be able to come out on their own and learn something. So I usually focus a lot on that. I might also then talk about anytime they bring up a skill, like, what is the purpose? What is the functional purpose? And sometimes I will challenge it, even if they tell me, well, ABA is working on blankety blank, or, oh, did he learn that in ABA? I might go, but why? My favorite example is a patient that was working on stacking blocks in ABA and then mastered it. And I was like, what does that mean? Why is that important to him? And I'm like, I've been working with him. He doesn't seem interested in stacking blocks. I don't see him generalize it. If I leave blocks out, he's not interested in stacking blocks. So you just taught him a skill that is kind of useless to him. Kids stack blocks in typical development, and it's a measure of typical development because they have underlying foundational skills. They have trunk control. They have coordination. They have visual motor accuracy. They have the perceptual ability to visualize the depth upward, right? To understand if I put these things on top of each other, they're going to balance and they're going to stabilize and they're going to build up taller and taller. And then they have this interest to explore their environment and to explore the properties, the sensory properties of these tasks. If your child doesn't have that, all you've taught them to do is memorize an activity. When you give me these particular blocks, I will do this specific task with it. But if I show you different blocks, or if I'm in a different environment or I don't attach a reward to it, I'm not going to go do that because I don't understand why I'm doing it. I'm just doing it so you'll leave me alone. So trying to put it into perspective for them like that. For a speech example is, you know, parents get really hung up on, I want them to use words. And I said, that's great, but what if they don't initiate language? We have lots of kids that learn to memorize words, but they don't learn the meaning from a behavioral approach. And therefore, they don't learn any engagement as well, obviously. So they don't have any desire to communicate. So they don't use their language unless you prompt them. Again, if you've met any of my Wednesday kids, I have a little guy who's very much like this. He has language, but he will not use it unless you tell him to use it. So if I want him to say hi to somebody, I have to say, Nathan, say hi, say bye, or whatever. That's not functional. That's just a memorized skill. So sometimes if you can give specific examples like this, those sometimes are aha moments for parents, I find, where they're like, oh, yeah. They get a little bit hung up on developmental checklists and wanting their kid to hit all those checklists. But you have to take it back and go, but why do you think your child's not meeting those tasks, those demands? And why do typical kids meet those? Usually it comes down to regulation, engagement, interest, ability to explore their environment, to motor plan. So you can tie it back in that way. Another thing I like to talk about a lot with parents when I'm discussing the distinction between these two is external and internal motivation. There's a lot of research to support that if we reward kids for particular behaviors or tasks, that we are actually only ever creating external motivation, and in the long term, it's actually damaging to their internal motivation. If you want a child to be independent in a task, truly functionally independent, they have to be internally motivated to behave in a certain way. We don't learn that from external rewards. It's just not how we function. So you're only going to get these really short-term gains, and probably not a lot of generalizability because the reward often is environmentally specific as well. I can't tell you how many kids I've worked with where the parent tells me, oh, yeah, no, they mastered stringing beads in ABA. And myself, the OT at school, not a single other person can get them to string beads in any other environment. I can't even get the child to regulate to come over to try to string the beads. It's not functional. So they can't do it on their own. They don't choose to do it on their own. It's not a functional skill. So that's a really important, I think, distinction for them too. The other thing I like to do, and I think probably my favorite way to educate parents about the difference is cueing them and labeling for them things happening in the session. So, for example, just last week I had a kiddo who went and chose the pool noodles and the little connectors and was putting things together. And for the first time, he actually took a different size or shape connector and he understood where it went. And I was like, did you see that? Look at how long he is visually attending to this task. He's really paying attention to the details of it. He's manipulating these objects. He's problem solving. He didn't do this just a couple months ago, you know? So showing them how what you're doing is making progress in these little tiny situations, it is often really small incremental gains, but we have to point that out to the parent constantly. And I think that's an area that we probably lack still compared to ABA. ABA is very data-driven. So they're getting constant reports of, look, your kid only stacked blocks 1 out of 5 trials. Now they're doing it 3 out of 5 trials. Now they're doing it 5 out of 5 trials. They've mastered this. The parent is motivated and bought in by this constant reminder of their child's progress. So we have to make sure we're doing that all the time throughout the session. Much of my education with parents is, look at that. Did you see that? Remember how he couldn't, you know, do this before? This one same patient, he wanted to leave the clinic and he actually opened up the door to the lobby. He had never done that before. And then he wanted to go to the bathroom. And normally he would just stand outside the bathroom door and he'd wait and he would, mom would pick up the pieces and go, oh, you want the bathroom? And she would do the rest of the sequence. But he actually push the door open, turn on the light, and went into the stall. And I'm like, look at how many extra steps he's done. He used to not be able to sequence that many steps before. That I think is really exciting for them, especially if you're getting excited about it. They're like, oh, this is really important. And this is, they're making good progress. The other thing that I often will explain to parents, and again, usually within situations so that it's meaningful in that moment, is I talk about how many steps of a sequence that activity was, or I talk about the differences. So if you're wondering why your child is having a hard time tying their shoes, think about all the sequences, the steps in that activity versus what they're currently doing. A lot of our kids are doing 1 to 2 step play ideas, right? They're swinging back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, rubbing their hand on the wall, up and down, up and down, up and down. It's very repetitive. Or they're lining up blocks. These are really limited play ideas. And to be functional, to have more independence, you have to be able to execute a series of steps in a row, which shows you have good attention, good memory, good, visualization, good sequencing, good problem solving, good persistence. And these are often the things that our kiddos are with autism are missing or, lacking a little bit. So you can explain those things to them and go, okay, well, if you want them to be able to do this, like, no wonder it's hard because look at how they're having a hard time with me here, So I'll also will tie everything I'm doing back to whatever that parent's concern is. So if that parent wants the child to sit at the table and write their name, I'm like, that takes a lot of work to sustain your attention without movement, sitting down, and complete a complicated motor task that requires lots of steps. If they can't just pay attention to me while they're swinging, how are they ever going to be able to do that? If you also put it back into perspective, and sometimes it's helpful when you assess them first to kind of figure out which levels are they deficient in, because each level has a corresponding age range to it. So, regulation is emerging around birth to 3 months. Engagement is around 2 to 7 months. So if you put it back into perspective of chronological age and typical development, that can also be eye-opening for a parent. I would also caution it can also be very overwhelming if you're telling a 10-year-old's mother that, hey, your child still has deficits with engagement, which occurs at 2 to 7 months old. So I would be careful how you bring it up and know the parent well so that you're not stressing them out too much. But it's helpful sometimes for them to know and say, okay, now think about a 2 to 7 month old. We all know what an infant is like. Imagine me forcing that child to sit at the table and write their name. You would never do that because they're not developmentally, it's not developmentally appropriate. They're not interested. They're not engaged. They don't quite have the skills. So sometimes it's a mismatch between they might have motor skills that have progressed higher up. They might have language skills that have progressed higher up. but often that social emotional area is still quite behind and limits them from generalizing and from really doing higher level activities. So, you know, it's not a, like a quick little speech that I give. This is education that is embedded into every session, into every activity that I do. These are parents that I want in the session. I'm like, you need to be in the session. Come sit, come watch. And I am labeling, verbalizing everything that I'm doing all the time because I need to constantly remind them why I'm doing what I'm doing. Really cool success story of this. A kiddo that I just recently discharged, actually. He had done ABA for many, many years. And her friends had kind of encouraged her to try DIR floor time. She finally tried it. He's like 9 or 10 at this point. So we have a lot of work to do. He couldn't even regulate through a session when I first started with him. Really poor motor planning, no language. I mean, really like poor engagement, everything. All these skills that they had worked so long. She goes, we worked for years on so many skills that he just never could get. Or he would get it, and every time we stopped ABA, we would lose the skill, or it would never generalize into other settings. And then she started this DIR approach, and we got her sucked in, really well educated. Mom clicked really well with the whole process, carried it over beautifully. And she told us on her last session, I look at the world differently now. I look at everything through a totally different lens because now I'm thinking about all these cool opportunities within this activity. You know, sometimes he wants to just open and close the microwave, but he didn't always have the force to do it. He didn't always have the persistence to know to keep pushing harder to get it to open up or to put something inside and take it out and close it, all those extra steps. One day she came in and she said, he figured out how to do snaps. And I said, that's so cool. We've never taught him to do snaps. We didn't need to. We helped him learn to pay attention, to engage, to motor plan, to stay regulated and persist with challenges, which include motor challenges. And he, on his own, started to explore with the snaps on his diaper bag and persisted to the point that he succeeded. And that is how true learning happens. So hopefully those will help you. Those examples will help you figure out different ways to educate your parents. Don't give up on them, even if they have a wall up at first. It is a really difficult thing. And honestly, some families we have educated, and they still just don't get it. I think some families, it's just too gray area. It's just too kind of fluid and nuanced. And they want so desperately for their child to just look normal that they kind of miss the details and really kind of miss the path. So you might catch that parent too early in their journey where they're just not ready for that knowledge and that information. That doesn't mean that you have failed them as a therapist, as long as you have given your best into the education piece. But hopefully you'll get enough of them at just the right moment that you'll be able to show them a different way, that there are other options besides behavioral approaches. Certainly, if you have any specific questions about anybody you're working with, you can reach out to me. I would be happy to chat. Thanks.